Simone.
Hey, Marina.
I have a question for you.
Shoot, go ahead.
If you could be a ninja or a pirate, which would you be?
You know what?
What?
I honestly reached into the depths of my being, and I think I would rather be a pirate.
Really?
Oh, maybe I'd be a ninja. I don't know. See, there are pitfalls to both.
There are, and there are definitely things that are awesome about each of them that the other one can't really possess. And part of that is because they're sort of opposite, right?
They really are, yeah. Ninja are like the total controlled, non-rambunctious, very disciplined, fearless,
yes,
and skilled people.
Exactly, and pirates are much louder and more rambunctious. And
yeah, less trained.
Less trained,
more
less
like
organized.
Haphazard. Yeah, just kind of like in it for themselves, too.
But both of them just constantly take names, and that's why I'd probably be cooler to be either one of them.
Yeah, they're just so... they're awesome.
I personally am partial to ninjas. I like the, you know, the idea of just being super disguised and in control of what you're doing and have everything so mapped out to the smallest detail that, you know, no one can really catch you at that point. Pirates are just more susceptible to, you know,
getting taken down by diseases, and they do. They're stinkier, I imagine, than ninja.
Yeah. I mean, if we were talking about, would you rather date a pirate or a ninja?
I would totally rather date a ninja.
Yeah, I would rather date a ninja.
Totally dateable material. Oh, so yeah. Guys out there, if you're looking to dress up as a ninja or a pirate for Halloween, if you're single, go for a ninja costume.
Costumes are only $20 to $30 on Amazon.
Yep.
And you probably land a lot of ladies.
Yeah, so as you might have guessed, we're either talking about ninjas or pirates in this podcast, and we're going to go with ninja because they're just more eligible in this case. No, also though, a really great hubber named Haunty on Hub Pages wrote not just one hub, but a series of articles on ninja everything, from the origins of ninjutsu to the very advanced tools that ninja use to get places and to fight and kill people.
And Haunty is an elite hubber, right?
Yes, Haunty is currently in the elite program, so we're just honored to have
And it seems people. Like from reading these hubs, he definitely knows what he's talking about.
Oh, he knows
about.
His stuff, yeah. He talks about a lot of stuff that I don't know where he found that information without speaking Japanese, because even upon many like visits to Japan, I wasn't able to garner so much. And I visited a lot of ninja-specific places because I think that they are cool.
Clearly his passion for ninjas and the history and culture behind how they arose and even just in practice how they operate is something that Haunty has a passion for writing about.
Yeah, pretty
and
extensive. And we're going
to
talk about
let's
one,
talk
two,
about
three, four... five, six, seven different hubs on Hub Pages that he wrote about ninja everything.
It's remarkable. Hopefully we can get through it all.
Yeah, we're just going to go through the highlights, but here we go. Let's start out. Why don't we start out with ninja training, which is ninjutsu.
Ninjutsu.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess the point he makes here is that in 15th century Japan, ninjas were born, not made.
Yes, so the way that it kind of worked is very similar to with samurai, is that you were born into a ninja clan. But in this case, unlike samurai clans, they did not necessarily have a single master to begin. Like, they're more mercenary-like.
Right.
So, yeah, but you would be trained from the start. You couldn't just be like, oh, I'm gonna go to ninja school.
Mommy, I wanna be a ninja. No.
Yeah.
It seems like it in those times, it was, as Haunty mentions, the recruitment was not even merit-based in any way. It was just negotiations between the warlords over the use of different ninja services. And so,
yeah,
you know, either you were in it or you were not in it. But I guess that changed shortly after.
Yeah. So according to Haunty, he says, at least this was the case until the beginning of the ninjutsu tradition, which is really where the training begins and all the fun happens. However, he says, when the first shogun of Japan, Tokugawa Iseo, siphoned into his care all the ninja of the Iga and Koga houses, which were the original ninja houses, the trained ninja warrior supply began to dwindle down. So that means that other warlords who basically didn't have those clans to pick from anymore because they all belonged to Tokugawa had to train their own in-house ninjas. So it was kind of like, you know, the greatest PR firm so that it gets bought up by Google. So everyone else has to have their own in-house PR because... Yep. Except that the PR people are trained assassins.
And we begin with the production of homegrown ninjas.
Yes! Hanji goes into specific detail describing one ninjutsu skill, or school, that was established by Nakagawa, Shoshunjin. There we go.
Nice.
Yeah, we do not speak Japanese, as you have probably quickly found out.
But Japanese is remarkably fun to read and pretend to speak. So we're going to be using a lot of Japanese terms in this podcast.
But this ninjutsu school started in 17th century Japan and was basically, it was a part of another lord's castle, essentially. So it was like their secret black ops section of that private military.
Which is, just to put in perspective, when we mentioned earlier that when ninjas were, when the families were arising, and it was early 15th century, so, 17th century had been a couple of years, or a couple hundred years until these schools really started to flourish anyhow.
Yeah, so in this school started out really small with just 10 samurai, and... I guess it really reminded me of like Black Ops, you know, like people from the military who are promising are taken aside and taken under the wing of, in this case, the amazing Nakagawa, who, this is really great, like when he wanted to qualify to, I guess, become the in-house ninja expert, the person sort of responsible for interviewing him said, well, you can, you know, you qualify if you can steal a pillow from under my head while I'm sleeping. This is probably very apocryphal, but I love the story. So this guy basically went to sleep and was like, ha, 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 he's never gonna make it. Ha, ha, ha. And then in the middle of the night, he hears rain on the roof, and then he feels rain
there's
on
a leak.
His face.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a leak. There's a hole in the roof. And so he lifts his head up to look and be like, where's this hole coming from? And then his pillow is gone, and then... Wah,
lo and behold.
Standing next to him is our good old Nakagawa, standing with his pillow, smiling, because he just...
Was out ninja'd.
Yeah, he pwned. So, yeah, this was a really qualified guy to be training this very small group of ninja. And the group eventually grew to be 20 people. But this one section of the castle where all the training took place was very secret. No one was allowed to go there. And a lot of mythology sort of sprung up around this school. Says Hanti in his article, in the Okufuji Monogatari, which I guess was the account of the show...
Shoshujin's life.
Yeah. Said that he could turn into a rat or a spider or a bird, which really does illustrate the extent to which people were like, he's magical, he's amazing.
The idea that ninja were superhuman, they could morph and transform into other creatures because they were so quick and stealth definitely fueled that kind of mythological... attachment.
Oh, yeah, they almost sound like vampires. You know, could just poof and they're bats or they're
or shapeshifters.
Yeah, totally.
The next point that Hanti makes is that the students themselves were called the Hayamichi no Mono, or the shortcut people. And their duties included a range of different things, but namely carrying out spy operations and the assassination of enemy leaders. Oh, you know, just your everyday shoot this guy. Mission. The Hayamichi no Mono were dispatched and revoked at the will of the daimyo alone, and their practices were kept secret. What's a daimyo again, Simone?
It's kind of like a generic term used to describe a powerful Japanese lord.
Right, and they were all sort of working for their different daimyos.
Yeah, because they were all kind of... Japan had this very interesting fragmented... weird territorial history, and for many periods there'd be like these different tentative alliances, and all these lords would be in this section, and then they had their...
It was a constant
army.
Power struggle,
yeah, so all
too.
These lords were kind of fighting for power, so everyone had like a small army, and then they had samurai, which were like higher up, you know, and they had their honor, but they were still warriors, and then there were ninja, there were secrets that no one talked about, so there was a lot of, the military seemed to be kind of a big deal at that time.
Right, and I guess selecting ninja was now much more merit-based, because at least Nakagawa got his job after proving his skills.
Yeah, so he set pretty high precedent. I really wonder what, you know, other people had to do to make the cut, to become one of those students in this really super secret school.
But assuming they did make the cut, and they were part of ninjutsu, ninja training starts, what, straight out of the womb?
Pretty much. Yeah, I mean, it kind of needs to. I mean, anyone who was a powerful or influential or, you know, somewhat decent warrior had to start from the beginning. And ninja had the same training that samurai got, which obviously involved swordsmanship, but also spear skills, guns, riding, swimming. But also they had to do some not so common samurai-like things, which were very specific just to the ninja area.
Right, like explosives, poisons, field craft, and survival skills. Water purification, I mean, those survival skills would include things like water purification and cooking, camping, drawing, reading, writing, and all of this.
Yeah, because you had to be a spy as well as an assassin. You know, you might need to seem like an educated, courtly person. And you had to do a lot more than just...
Yeah, you'd have to be a spy when you're, you know, interacting with people and kind of the undercover style, and then also just in harsh conditions where you straight up have to hide. And we'll learn, I guess, later when we discuss the various tools being used, you know, having to stay underwater for a long period of time, breathing only through a bamboo.
Just like in the movies.
Just like in the movies, and you have to be prepared for anything, pretty much.
Yeah, you do. And
so training was intense.
It was extremely intense, and to compare it to samurai training, again, it was all those things plus more. And samurai training alone is super intense. Have you heard of Hagakure? I think that's what it's called. It's the Book of the Samurai. And it was kind of written by this one guy who kind of became to be seen as the definitive, like, oh yeah, this is like, our bro
the samurai Bible.
It's the bro Bible of samurai, except maybe the Book of the Samurai is the original bro Bible.
Probably is.
Except
I think
it's
the
so
bro Bible
not about,
draws
like,
a lot from.
Yeah, but this it's really beautiful. I'm actually starting to read it again. And it's very beautiful and poetic, but it's also, it goes to show just how intense it is to be a samurai. So, I mean, like, there's one very famous principle that comes from it, like, where if you have to choose between life and death, always choose death, for then you'll never be afraid.
Yes.
And just this idea of living where you're like, yeah, if I had the chance to die by the sword, I'm gonna do it, you know, like, I'm not there yet.
It's so much... A large component of it is mental and psychological, and just being in the right place with yourself to be able to
and be ready to die too. It's not just a matter of
You can't fear death, essentially.
You choose death. You actively choose it, and then beyond that, it's not even being afraid to die in battle. But if you fail, or if you embarrass yourself, or if you make your lord mad at you, you have to be prepared to commit ritual suicide, or hagakure, which was not pleasant because it involved slicing open your stomach.
Also known as seppuku.
Yeah, that's more like
the
slang
best Japanese
term for
word
it.
Ever.
I know, seriously.
But it was not pretty. You had to, don't you pull your intestines out? Is that kind of...
Yeah, you slice your belly open, and then you theoretically hope that you have a buddy nearby to cut off your head after that happens, but sometimes you just have to go it alone and, you know, wait it out.
Yeah. So that's sort of, you know, there are a lot of similarities
across... Well, that's just the same. That's, like, intense enough, in addition, ninja had to add stealth.
Yes.
They had to add distraction, disguise, assassination, plus there was no glory. So if they, you know, just totally pulled off a mission and saved the world, whatever,
there was
no one
cookie.
Would ever know.
Yeah.
You just tied. No cookies.
There was no pat on the back. There was nothing. And that I just think is the most interesting and noteworthy distinction between the two, is that ultimately samurais get to wear a flag.
They never try to hide.
They
know?
Don't, yeah.
It's all very honor-based. It's all very out in the open. Ninja, nope, not so much.
Right, not so much. And no glory is kind of, once again, it's that type of person that is willing to do whatever it takes and never really get any recognition for it.
Maybe that's why they seem like such good dates.
Yeah.
They're just so... Because pirates are just kind of like... Argh.
Yeah, I mean, take you out on a five-course dinner and a great Broadway show and, yeah. and not even mention or want a thank you.
Yeah.
It's sort of become the norm. I don't know if it would translate that way, perfect. But...
Let's just pretend that it does.
I, even if it didn't, I would still be down to try it out.
Oh, me too.
So I guess that covers the first hub.
Yeah, so ninja training, done.
Ninja training, done.
Let's talk about Iga and Koga then.
Sure. Iga and Koga, as described by Hanti, are the homelands of the ninjutsu and the ninja. And there's an ancient photograph of ancient Japan that portrayed where these two, where the Iga province and the southern area of the Ami province, which is known as the Koga, are located. And they're kind of smack dab in the middle of Japan in a fully landlocked area, which is kind of perfect for training grounds for the ninja.
It is. It was surrounded by high mountains, too, so it was hard to access.
A lot of the communities themselves were sort of fragmented and, you know, there were more like nomadic, I believe, families there. It wasn't very organized, I guess.
Yes, and there was also a natural crossing between the primary trade routes from Kyoto and other mountain ranges on the Kii Peninsula, which means that there was a lot of trade going through, which also meant that there were a lot of ruffians in the area. So each of those local villages had to learn how to defend themselves, which Hanti says easily gave rise to a more mercenary kind of culture.
And
you know,
more liberal in general.
Yeah, everyone's out for themselves. Yeah, more liberal, more isolated. You know, there's not this like huge city daimyo-centric mentality.
Right.
So it makes sense that these original clans of ninja and then, you know, just an ideology could have sprung from that.
Right.
Which is super interesting.
It was divorced from the areas that were much more in control of those things. But Hanti describes that, or Hanti actually, to quote him, he says, "The many clans who ruled various parts of the mountains of Iga and Koga were allied in a fairly complex hierarchy of mutual support, creating optimal conditions for mercenary activity to thrive," which, as we just discussed, makes a lot of sense. The Iga itself was the landlocked area, and it was a politically sensitive area, interestingly enough.
Yeah, well, though, when I think about like Japan in those times... Was there any area that was not politically sensitive?
I mean, is there any area that isn't politically sensitive?
Yeah, really.
Now, even in Japan, but especially then.
Yeah.
So, to sum that up, the place, the area and the boundary that created the optimal conditions for the ninja to thrive and to carry out their missions.
Well, it's interesting. I don't think many people realize that tradition actually emerged from one specific area. So
yeah.
I like that.
I like that too.
I learned that. I actually went to Iga and ate.
Did you?
And an Iga Ninja Village.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I learned that a little bit earlier, but I didn't realize before that point that, you know, there was this place. But, you know, so I want to talk about something, and this is another hub, actually, that Hanti did.
This was my favorite, I think, or one of, definitely the first one that excited me.
It's called Inside a Ninja House. So, yeah. The thing is that, and Hanti points this out too, this concept of a ninja house, it's a big tourist thing in Japan. When I went to Iga, I went to the Iga village and I saw the ninja house. And it's
so
this
lucky.
Tricked out house that's, you know, like, oh yeah, you know, back in the ninja days, ninja had like special houses because they knew that they were in danger and they knew all these special techniques. And I mean, no one's exactly sure if this was a common thing. That said, maybe elements of ninja houses existed in castles and other things. In fact, let's talk about the ninja house first and then talk
sure.
about how that might exist in reality a little bit more practically. But basically, in this ninja village that I visited, and as described by Hanti, like a ninja house has all these awesome ninja elements.
Oh, yeah, it's super... duper just
ninja-y.
Tricky. It's like a maze. I mean, you walk in and...
Yeah, you would die if you walked in.
you
if
could just die.
If you dead, you could, yeah, it would be bad.
Take the wrong step left and you're suddenly falling into a ditch full of knives. I mean, it's just...
Yeah,
and
because they had trap doors like that,
oh,
you know, that if you didn't know where you were going, Yeah, they also had really cool things like...
secret rooms.
Yeah, secret rooms that, you know, instead of just like a sliding panel or something, they actually have... They have panels that pivot.
Yes.
On a pole, so if you step into the right part of it, you'll just disappear in a flash.
And there is a video of all of this in Haunty's Hub inside the Ninja House that is really, really cool.
Yeah.
Especially this part of the sliding panel, because it happens so fast that it truly is a trip to watch. There are obviously a ton of unexpected trapdoors leading to things like poison spiked pits.
Mm-hmm.
There are various secret rooms that would appear, you know, in areas that didn't look like there was a room coming up.
Yeah,
or
secret stairways.
Exactly, vanishing staircases.
Yeah.
That they could fold away. There were concealed storage spaces where they hid various weapons.
Yeah, and, like in the floorboards, you could be sitting and suddenly, whoosh, whoosh, and then you just...
Yeah, and all this is
someone.
So intricate that, it, you know, the floorboard, for example, at least in the video in the Hub... you know, if you step on it, it's not going to open. But
yeah.
if you do the special kind of kick on the right side, you open it the right way, and you have, you know, a second to grab the sword, which I just love how quickly all of these things happen.
Yeah, and I had to say, when I went to that ninja house in reality, and you can actually watch a video of it on Haunty's Hub. The
same house you went to.
Yeah, the same house. The people demonstrating do it very ninja fast, and it's very realistic, and it's surprising to see just how fast they move. And while I'm not exactly sure if ninja houses were all that common, there were still a lot of crazy designs that were used not just in what I'm sure were wealthier homes, but also in castles to
protect
help.
The Diamo.
Yeah, and also there were all these counter. Defense things. For example, there's this castle in Kyoto called Nijo Castle, which I visited, that has these floors called Nightingale floors. And because ninja were so stealthy, a lot of lords took many huge efforts to make sure that they would hear them no matter what, matter how quiet they were. So these Nightingale floors of this one castle actually make this whistling sound as any weight shifts across them, no matter how softly you walk. It's incredible, so that no one could walk anywhere without everyone hearing it.
Man, my parents would have loved having floors like that in
my
house
right?
in high school.
Yeah, right?
Because you have to do the tiptoe barefoot thing.
Well, yeah, and... but and everyone has that one squeaky spot.
Oh, yeah.
But you know where it is.
You do, and you can avoid it.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't doubt that those component designs that show up in the ninja house existed in pieces all over the place.
Yeah, I'm sure it existed in pieces all over the place, and it is sort of not necessarily easy to believe that these houses existed and were labeled as such and were just so prominent and obvious at the time that it does seem like more of a development of something that's now become more touristy.
Small
in
elements,
Japan, but
the
influence
ninja,
is there.
The ninja industry is now really just one based on excitement and conjecture. That's okay. One of the things that I love most about visiting the ninja house is that, I mean, obviously there were lots of guys walking around in ninja costumes with weapons, which gets me all hot and bothered. But the girls had the most adorable ninja costumes because they were bright pink. Which is not great for concealment.
It's really not.
But it's great for adorablement.
It is. And, maybe that's part of that ninja strategy is...
to look cute.
To not look like a ninja. Just to look like an adorable little kind of... I don't even know. The pink outfits were just so... they made me smile, so...
they made me smile, too.
But I don't think they make me smile if,
they were trying.
They were
to
about to kick my ass,
so
that would be
not.
Bad.
Yeah, but I mean, it brings up an interesting discussion, which moves us to our next point: ninja
costumes,
outfit, and armor. So the first point that Haunty brings up on the subject of ninja garb is that this whole black thing really—it's a myth.
Yeah.
I mean, there were probably times when legit early ninja did wear black to conceal themselves while sneaking around. However, most ninja dressed like anyone would dress now to blend in with the crowd.
Right, because just because you're wearing all black, that doesn't mean you really blend into all of your surroundings.
Precisely.
And although that's the common, idea we think of when we think of, you know, burglars trying to sneak in or anyone trying to...
Yeah, you know, like blacked out face.
The better way to camouflage is to look like everyone else.
Totally,
not to look like a dude fully concealed with only your eyes showing and a sword just chilling.
Just chilling. Well, but what I found that was... I learned this and it was brand new to me. Hanti pointed out that as traditional artistic convention in Japan had it, a character dressed in black meant that they couldn't be seen by other characters, like in a puppet show or in other theater. So it's kind of like the equivalent of, like, you know, drawing like a dotted line in a comic strip, I bet, you know, like for a shape. You know, no one else can see it, but, you know, the audience can. And I think that early illustrations of ninja dressed in black were misinterpreted. You know, people didn't realize, oh, that's a common, you know, aesthetic convention saying you can't see him. You know, they thought that was really how they were dressed.
Yeah.
So that's a very interesting theory as to why we think that ninja dress in that manner.
Yeah, I mean, I guess a lot of those are influenced by these early photographs that, like you said, were just misinterpreted all over the place.
They really just did blend in with other, I mean, in another hub called How to Be a Ninja in Disguise, Hanti talks about how the most common get-ups that you would find a ninja wearing were not ninja clothes at all. They were maybe, if they were traveling, it would be either as a Zen Buddhist monk or maybe a Yamabushi, which is a mountain monk, because that's what who you would see traveling by themselves, you know?
Right,
and if they were trying to spy, it would be a kind of dancer or a puppeteer.
Yeah. I mean, those are all, you know, solitary, kind of nomadic
lifestyle.
It makes sense. And that's,
you'd see those persons.
That's an identity they could sort of take upon themselves to emulate.
I have to say, I was really disappointed when I went to the Ninja Village and they told me that. I was like, dang it. They dress like normal people. And that's the whole thing happened to me again in modern times. When I went to school in D.C. and we had the FBI come and, like, speak to one of our classes once. And one of the agents, like, there was an agent that was going to come talk to us. And, of course, we're all, like, picturing, you know, movie stars and, like, these amazing, like, whoa, an agent. And the person who ended up talking to us was the most bland person you could, and intentionally so. Because you don't want to recognize these people's faces.
Yeah.
They shouldn't be particularly tall or good looking or striking in any way. Just utterly forgettable. You know, it's always such a letdown when you figure out that, like, spies or, like, assassins are actually like that, because it's like, no.
Oh, no, they're
no.
not. Yeah. They don't look like Daniel Craig or...
Yeah, but that's just how it was. But still, we can talk about what the idealized ninja dress is like, right? I mean,
yes.
Because there still is sort of this common convention of what the ninja outfit is.
And that is the common idea of what the ninja outfit is includes several little different components, like the jacket. If you think similar to the karate or judo jacket, there's no straps and it's tucked in to make it easier to move, essentially.
You don't want to get caught on stuff. How embarrassing.
You don't want to be wearing a baggy cape. You know, you need to be wearing something that kind of sticks to your body. No capes for ninjas. Trousers, similar to the samurai horse or riding pants. Cloth garters over the calves. Black samurai socks, also known as tabi, on the feet.
Yeah, they have little big toe sections.
Yes.
So cute.
They're like the gloves for feet.
Yep.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Waraji, which are the straw sandals, and the head wrapped in a cowl covering all but the eyes.
Yep, that's the classic getup. So
and
if you want to go for that for Halloween,
yes,
go ahead. Or dress as a Japanese Buddhist monk and be like, no.
Oh, that would be a much better...
That would be such a zinger.
Yeah, and that's another reason why ninjas are cooler than pirates. I mean, you can spot a pirate from 20 miles away.
You can smell a pirate from 20 miles away.
You can smell a pirate, and you can hear a pirate arguing from a mile away. And so, I don't know. I like the surprise element of, oh, you know, that guy's putting on a puppet show. No, actually, he's not putting on a puppet show.
I bet you guys didn't think of that, huh? Ninja as a puppeteer?
Yeah. I think that's a great disguise.
Me too.
But regardless, the outfit itself was accompanied with some lightweight body armor. The Ahigatu Kote, which is the sleeve armor, and the Sunete, which were shin guards.
Yeah, and this was all basic infantry style armor. When you go to like samurai armor, man, it's huge, heavy, it's elaborate, it's gorgeous. But it's not the kind of thing you can really sneak around in. Because again, samurai were all about honor and being seen and being right out there.
Right.
So let's get to the fun part. Let's talk about the killing implements.
There were a ton of tools that Hanti
discussed.
Yeah, we can't from like them all. From like the basics to like, you know, the specialized
circumstances for both standard ninja equipment and specialized ninja equipment, which is insane.
It is. And so standard ninja equipment, which what you're probably used to seeing once again, the classical kind of ninja ensemble included obviously, a sword, which
the katana is the
traditional Japanese sword. And the difference between that and the type of sword the samurai typically use is that the katana was shorter and a straighter version, make it easier to use for climbing.
For carrying around. Have this big honking thing, especially if you're fighting in smaller spaces. You know, it's just not practical.
Yeah, and the idea was, I think, to use it exactly to scale walls, to use it for other things, and it was worn over the shoulder.
Yeah.
So the katana was kind of like your staple, like the pocket knife of ninja gear.
The pocket knife of ninja. No, I think that I'm going to argue that the shuriken, the ninja stars, I misspelled that.
Oh, those are good.
They're so cute.
They are.
And I want to get a bunch. I don't know if they're legal to buy in California, but I want to get a bunch. I have some throwing knives, but they're huge. And shuriken are so pretty.
Next team outing.
Let's learn how to throw some weapons.
Another one is the kaginawa, which is hooked rope for climbing walls and trees. The grapnel. And this is, if you can imagine, just a thick rope, kind of in a circular, tied up with just knives in equal intervals.
It's pretty
across
neat.
It.
And I like it. Yeah.
I would be very, very scared to try and use one of those. But
But what even scares me even more, because it's just kind of small and really like, it hurts my feet to think about it, is the tetsubishi, which were basically just caltrops and the little like iron spikes that are designed so that no matter how they fall, you know, they look kind of like jacks.
Yes.
They always have a sharp spike sticking up. And since everyone just wore thin sandals.
Sandals.
I mean, you were screwed.
Yeah.
If you walked on those, you know, unless you're wearing those really thick wooden ones, which I will wear in ancient Japan from now on. Next time I go, you know.
Let's not forget all about the poisons and the antidotes.
Yeah, yeah.
They were essential, and they were easier to carry around, probably. And
one of
those things.
And then basic things like, you know, hat for protection from the elements, and a towel, which they called the Sanjaku Tenuji?
Yeah.
And I love that there's just like a towel. Yeah. It's that the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy rule.
Yeah.
You know, rule one, don't panic. Wasn't rule two always have a towel with you?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, so, dude, ninja, totally ahead of the game on that.
Yeah, I mean, towels, we don't need to get into the details, but it's good to carry one around. Uchitake. Waterproof gunpowder container.
Yeah, because they like to blow things up.
Remember, ninjas rolled with explosives,
they
unlike
totally
the samurai.
Did. Yeah.
The Inro, which was the medicine carrier, interlocking compartments. Once again, the whole culture of the ninja being able to do all sorts of non-fighting type.
Yeah, and you gotta carry your poisons and antidotes and something.
Exactly.
You also have your sekihitsu, which is your writing kit.
Because you have to be literate.
And you gotta write letters. Well, and also one of the big training aspects of being a ninja is you have to learn how to draw like maps.
Yeah.
So you might draw your map. But let's talk about the specialized stuff because this was really cool.
Yeah. A lot of these came from, I guess, Benson Shukai, which is the famed 17th century ninja manual.
Yeah.
I want me one of those.
Yeah. But there were lots of, one of the things that I did see at this ninja village that I visited was the famed Mizugomu, or wooden water shoes, which were used to cross boats. And they're these
awkward
looking, like round, they look kind of like lily pads slash snowshoes that could be used to walk.
To be honest, another reason why ninjas are so remarkable is how, like, I couldn't imagine carrying those or walking in them. I mean,
let's just say awkward.
They're clunky and awkward, but I mean, sometimes you got to cross moats.
Well, the big point that Hansi made is that they could all swim.
Yeah,
so
of course.
Rarely were the Mizugumo or the rope ladders that they would sometimes use also to cross moats used. However, if they were carrying with them explosives or some other kind of materials that
they
could
couldn't
not
get
wet,
yeah,
they had to be a little bit more creative. And they would also use things for climbing walls because, man, castle walls in Japan are insane.
Yeah.
And even though the castles will burn down and have been rebuilt time and time again, man, these amazing moats and walls just go up forever. So they had to have a lot of special climbing materials, including just like crampons and ladders. And special, sometimes the walls were tiled, so they had special tools to kind of cut into it and climb. It's really impressive.
A couple of those tools are the kunai, which is a knife and paint scraper, and that's...
It's kind of like a combination of the two that was used to, like,
get through tile walls.
Yeah.
And the kurokagi, which is a metal climbing device consisting of a strong iron hook mounted on a wooden handle. Just another way to get through these tough walls.
Yeah, and other, like the hokore, which were sort of like hand quals.
Those are cool.
They were used for climbing walls, but then also you could fight with them.
Oh, yeah.
Gotta have those multitaskers.
I love the idea of hand claws. I don't know, just, like, multitasking.
With claws.
You could really mess someone up with one of those.
Yep.
The tagagi, which were knuckle dusters.
Yep. And then also, once you get inside a castle, you might use something like the Sauto Hikigani, which were portable listening devices that you could use to, you know, put up against a wall, kind of like an ear horn, just kind of listen into the conversation.
And the Hamagari, which was a long, thin saw.
Used to saw. Yeah, there are a couple different saws that Hansi talked about. And finally, you know, basic bows and arrows, which everyone knew how to use those.
Meh.
Boring. Actually, I love bows and arrows.
That's just a given, though, you know.
Yeah, the final thing that sounded really ominous to me was the shinobigama, sometimes also known as the kusarigama, which is a sickle and chain hybrid. Sounds like bad news.
Yeah, that I would not want to encounter one of those.
I'm picturing like Grim Reaper nunchucks.
Oh yeah.
I don't think that's what it looks like, but that just sounds really, really scary.
It does, and that concludes all of the various tools that Hansi discussed. And
yeah,
it was
at least a
really
summary
extensive.
Of them, because there's so much more in all of these hubs, and this was what again, like 1, 2, 3, 4,
seven
hubs. I think there might have been another one too that there's too much awesome
and too much needing to go to Wikipedia to figure out, you know, what's really going on, because there's so much information in these hubs that...
Well, that's what I so appreciate is that Hansi's really put a lot of this together, because the hard thing with ninja lore is that there's so much fiction now. There's really more fiction than there is reality,
and parsing through those two and trying to weed out the...
And Hansi did a good job with that.
I think Hansi did a great job with
that. Yeah, so this is a really good place to start if you're interested in ninja. Go to Hub Pages, look up Hansi as a user. You can go to hansi.hubpages.com and just search ninja under Hansi's hubs. And,
or search for Inside the Ninja House, and you can start there with the video.
Yeah, that one's really fun.
That's really fun.
Yeah. I don't know what else there is to say, because ninja are just kind of cool, but we do want to say that if you have your own personal ninja story, maybe how you did your own ninja training when you were a teenager, or if you too have been to the ninja village and what you thought of it, if you saw any of the demonstrations.
Have a compelling reason for why pirates are cooler than ninjas, or vice versa.
Ooh. Yeah, tell us. Yeah,
share it.
Pirates versus ninja. Tell us by sending us an email. Our address is podcast@hubpages.com.
Do it.
Yeah, we love to hear from you. Honestly, it's like we get really excited.
Especially when it's on a topic like this. So.
Yeah, so just write to us, podcast@hubpages.com. In the meantime, I think we should read some comments from some listeners who responded to our podcast on whether or not to marry.
That sounds like a great idea. That was a good one. It was a bit more serious. but...
Yeah, it was definitely more serious, although, like, killing people and being a spy is kind of serious. But, oh, more exciting than I think failed marriages. So
yes.
This was kind of tough. Now, the thing is that Marina and I are both somewhat young. We have not been married before. So we really did appreciate the perspective that a lot of our listeners did bring who had been in marriages and were able to maybe bring more to the table experience-wise than we were, because we basically just looked at the advice that was shared by one of our hubbers. So one person that wrote in is known as Kalini2010 on Hub Pages, but her name is Svetlana. And she basically shared some good sayings that she's been sticking by. She says the best advice is, in any case, marry. Either you will be happy or become a philosopher. She also says that there's a Russian saying of, don't get born beautiful, get born happy. And I like both of those things. Unfortunately, Svetlana shares that she was born both beautiful and a philosopher. So she was kind of doomed.
Doomed from the get-go.
Yes. Says Svetlana, yes, I wed for all the wrong reasons. There are no right or wrong reasons. There are no right or left reasons. Everyone makes the best decision possible given the knowledge at the particular moment. It's only later they learn what is wrong or incompatible or unbearable. You see, I'm a philosopher. And, you know, I'm really glad, Svetlana, that you said that because, you know, Marina and I can be all like, yeah, you shouldn't get married, you know, make stupid decisions and stuff. But then again, like, in the heat of a moment, how can you truly know if something's going to last forever? And the answer is you can't.
You don't.
Which is, I think, one reason why in that podcast we talked about how once you do get married, you should have, like, you should just communicate. And if it's not right, you know, have an out. Or be like, you know, maybe after 10 years, let's just promise to reconsider this.
I believe this was called the marriage contract,
the
right,
marriage
Simone?
Contract, yes. You know, we've got a lot of out clauses. So.
Exactly. Out clause is necessary.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Svetlana's perspective was a great one. Mm-hmm. And it is true. You can't really truly know whether or not you're doing something as important as, you know, getting married to someone for the rest of your life. You can't know whether or not it's the right decision 100% at the time.
Totally,
you know?
True.
And that's true for a lot of things. It takes experience to get to, you know, these realizations.
And sometimes you're going to make mistakes. And that's
yes.
Okay. Although, well, we heard from another anonymous commenter in this case who definitely, yeah, I think, would agree with the thesis of the should you get married or not.
This was a really fantastic kind of response to our podcast because
she
went through three marriages that sort of one after the other failed for completely different reasons. And sort of her approach was that, you know, these were the wrong reasons to get married. I mean, her first marriage, she says she fell for a military man, which, you know, because of his work and the lifestyle that marriage kind of fostered was doomed from the beginning. It didn't endure the fact that, or she was not able to endure the fact that it was during Vietnam War and, you know, being a military wife in itself. Her second marriage failed because, well, she had a child from her first marriage and I guess pressure from her family resulted in getting married to somebody to help take care of the child. That marriage lasted 10 years and was terminated because it became abusive. The last marriage was somebody that, you know, seemed to be perfect once again right away, and there were 3 years of dating before they got married. But ultimately that one failed because he cheated on her and took a lot of her money and, you know, left her brokenhearted and alone, which is all very depressing. That all being said, she now is in a relationship with another man. They're not married.
And they're not going to get married.
And they're not going to get married. And they've been having a great time, she says, that because they're compatible with one another and they have their lives together, but they maintain their separate kind of individual lives and pursue their individual goals, which we did discuss in the podcast as being something to not lose sight of. And that was mentioned in the Hub. So thank you so much, Anonymous, for sending us this really well-written piece about your account on what we talked about. Really brought a new perspective. I mean, Simone and I really won't know until we go through some marriages of our own.
Marriages and divorces. I'm looking forward to, because honestly...
Contract expirations.
I'm looking forward to my contract expirations, and I've also discovered the world of divorce cakes, which I've got to tell you, they are hilarious. So, you know what? Divorce doesn't have to be so bad.
Divorce, yeah, I agree with that.
They're really funny. They're like, you know, wives kicking husbands down three-tiered cakes spattered in blood. Like,
oh, I'm talking, that's messy.
Yeah, I'm talking really hilarious. So, you know what? Take this all. Try to have a sense of humor. Thank you, everyone, for writing in. We hope to hear
from you
about ninja versus pirate issues, because that's going to be awesome. And until then, try not to get killed by secret Buddhist monk disguised people.
Thanks for listening.